In 1987, at the awards dinner for the American Association of Forensic Scientists, the then president of the association, Donald Harper Mills, told a fascinating story about a man named Ronald Opus who was found dead. He'd left a suicide note and then jumped off the top of a 10-story building. A pretty easy open and shut case, right? Death by suicide. But not so fast, because detectives noticed a bullet wound in Ronald Opus' forehead. When they dug further, they discovered in a 9th-floor apartment where an old man and an old woman lived, they noticed a bullet hole in one of their windows. It turns out the old man and the old woman had been in a furious argument that evening. She pulled out the family shotgun, pointed it at her husband, fired, missed her husband. The bullet went through the window of their apartment just as Ronald Opus was free-falling past, striking him in the forehead. So the bullet that the old woman shot was the proximate cause of Ronald Opus' death. He was dead long before he hit the ground, meaning she was guilty of murder. Case closed, right? Not so fast. Because the old man and the old woman insisted to the detectives that this was how they always argued. When they would get into an argument, she would go grab the gun. They both knew it was always unloaded. By the way, I do not recommend these kinds of arguments. She knew that he knew it was unloaded. She would point it at him, pull the trigger. That would be the end of the argument. All of which raised the question, who put the bullet in the shotgun? Another witness told the detectives that months earlier, the son of the old man and old woman had confided to him that his old man, his father, had disinherited him, and he was so furious, knowing how his mother argued with his father, he put the bullet in the shotgun, hoping that the next time they argued, she would shoot the old man for him. So now we've solved the crime. The son of the old man and the old woman was the proximate cause of Ronald Opus' death. He is guilty of murder, right? Not so fast. Because when the detectives inquired as to the identity of the son of the old man and old woman, they were stunned to learn that the son's name was none other than Ronald Opus. Ronald Opus was the son who put the bullet in the shotgun, and therefore, he was the proximate cause of his own death as he jumped off the top of the apartment building, which takes us back to where we started, death by suicide. Whew. Quite a story, eh? We humans love nothing better than a story that has some unexpected and dramatic plot twists. Today's scripture passage is like that. Today, as we continue our sermon series on heaven, we come to a biblical story about something that happens in heaven that involves a dramatic plot twist that's meant to teach us something very important about heaven and about how we live our lives down here. Let's say a prayer and then we're going to dig in. God, open our eyes to the mystery of life and death and the life to come and how it all fits together so that our experiences here can be put in the perspective of eternity so that we can live as wise souls. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. What is the source of the greatest suffering you have ever experienced? How would you answer that question? I ask because we all have a story. The way I would answer that question, I would probably say that the greatest source of suffering I've experienced heretofore in life would be growing up gay in a world that at that time had no understanding or empathy for that. I didn't even understand it. I just knew that I was different and that I did not fit in. And when you don't fit in, when you feel like an alien life form, the pain of the isolation can be excruciating. For my sister, her greatest pain would be the death of her beloved husband after a long struggle with ALS. For my other sister, it would be the pain of divorce. For my husband, David, though I don't want to put words in his mouth, I would probably say his greatest suffering, other than being married to me, which, as you can imagine, is a special cross to bear. But other than that, I would say his greatest source of suffering is probably his seizure disorder, never knowing from day to day, when am I going to have a dizzy spell? When am I going to have a brief blackout? Or what will be the side effects of my seizure medicines today? Because when your health does not cooperate with you, that can bring a lot of suffering into your life. For my dad, his greatest suffering would be his loneliness. In his old age, after the death of my mother, I heard a Shenandoah song the other day that has a line in it that says, I'm a ghost in this house, shadows on the wall. And I thought of my dad and where he finds himself at this time in his life. My point is, there's a lot of suffering in life, and none of us is exempt. Amy Carter had just led a large women's conference. As the auditorium was emptying out, there was one woman who sat near the back of the auditorium, her head, her shoulders down, looking despondent. So Amy went back, sat down next to her, and asked what was going on. The woman began to tell Amy her story, how she was the mother of three children. Her oldest son had spent most of his 17 years in a wheelchair with cerebral palsy. Her other two kids had their own challenges, a learning disability and an emotional disability. She went on to tell Amy, I'm married to a mean and hateful man who refuses to help me with the children. He won't even help me hold my son when he's in the bathroom. And on top of all that, she told Amy, last week I buried my father, and at the funeral I learned he had disinherited me because of his hatred for my husband. I came to this conference, she told Amy, with one prayer in my heart. God, I pray that you will take my husband's life. I feel trapped. I feel like a bird in a cage. But here, at this conference, she said, I heard God speaking to me clearer than ever before. And God said to me, even a caged bird sings. She said to Amy, what am I supposed to do with that? How am I supposed to live with that answer? I share these stories in hopes that they help us to get in touch at a gut level with what we already know. There is a lot of suffering in life. Plenty to go around. So what happens to all that suffering when we get to heaven? There's a famous Bible verse about heaven that goes like this. Revelation 21:4. God will wipe away every tear from our eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the first things have passed away. So I guess that means when we get to heaven, all of our earthly suffering is going to disappear to be remembered no more as if it never happened, right? Absolutely wrong. I would contend that that is a misinterpretation and misapplication of Revelation 21:4. How can I be so sure? Because of what today's Bible passage tells us about heaven. Last week, we began looking at a great vision of heaven that God gave to the Apostle John as recorded in the book of Revelation. That vision spans two chapters, Revelation 4 and Revelation 5. Last week, we focused on Revelation 4 and what it can teach us about the importance of worship in heaven and in our life now. But today, we're moving into the second half of that vision, the rest of the story, chapter 5, to see what that tells us about heaven. The background to all of this is that the early Christians were experiencing great suffering at the hands of the Roman Empire. So John and his fellow Christians were desperate to know what the future would hold for them. It's at that point, as we move early into chapter 5, that John sees a great scroll that appears in heaven that contains the answer to his questions about the future. John wants to know. He's desperate to know. Revelation chapter 5, verse 2, John says, "I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?' But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep bitterly." John was bitterly disappointed. But then, verse 5, "One of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah,'" that would be Jesus, "'the root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." Oh my goodness. You realize, don't you, what that means? Jesus is going to appear on heaven's stage before our very eyes via John's vision, the one that we have always heard about, the one we have tried to picture a million different times, the one whose face we have longed to see. Jesus is about to appear in heaven, exalted and back in his rightful place in heaven. Jesus is about to appear to us, and I can't help but wonder, what will he look like? What form will he take now that he is exalted and in heaven? We don't have to think very hard before we get a pretty good guess. After all, the angel gives us some very important clues. Lion of the tribe of Judah. So maybe in his exalted heavenly state, Jesus will appear to us in the form of a mighty roaring lion, triumphant, conquering. Or maybe the key clue is the second phrase that is used by the angel about Jesus, the root of David. That's a reference, of course, to the famous King David, of whom Jesus was a descendant and rightful heir to his throne. So maybe in heaven, in his exalted state, Jesus appears in the form of a regal king, complete with elegant robes, golden crown, and scepter, and the authority to command all of the armed forces of heaven. The Lord of lords, the King of kings, the master of the seas, the creator of the ends of the world, is about to appear before our very eyes in this vision. I can't wait to see what Jesus is going to look like. Are you ready for this? Drum roll, please. And then comes the plot twist. When Jesus appears, we gasp. Everyone gasps. John himself must have gasped at what he saw. Revelation 5:6. "Then I saw between the throne and the four creatures and among the elders a lamb." A little lamb, for heaven's sakes. What happened to the mighty roaring lion? But that's not all. "I saw a lamb standing as if it had been slaughtered." OMG. The dictionary defines a lamb as a young sheep, not even full grown. But worse yet, that little lamb was standing there as if it had been slaughtered. Can you imagine what John saw? We don't know, obviously, exactly, but it isn't hard to imagine. Remember, back in ancient times, sheep were to shepherds, like pets are to us today. Shepherds would spend countless hours with their sheep, getting to know them, giving them names, and loving them like we love our pets today. So if Jesus were to appear to us today in this same vision, in a form that was culturally relevant to us today, we would probably see Jesus as something like a severely wounded puppy dog, all bandaged up, limping about. Something like this. Behold your king! Substitute a lamb for this puppy dog, and you can begin to approximate how Jesus appeared to John in heaven in this vision. Why? Why on earth would Jesus, in his exalted and heavenly state, choose to appear in a form that so vividly depicts his greatest earthly suffering? I thought there were no tears in heaven. I thought there was going to be no pain in heaven. True, but apparently that doesn't mean that we won't remember our earthly suffering. Wait a minute. How can those two things be true at once? How can Revelation 21:4 be true and Revelation 5 also be true? How can it be true that there will be no pain, no tears in heaven, but we will also be able to vividly remember our most bitter earthly suffering? Think about it like this. Imagine a mother who loses her child in the crossfire of a drive-by shooting. Imagine years later when that mother appears in heaven. She sits with an angel and begins to tell that angel about the huge hole, the untimely death of her child left in her soul. And the angel says, "Shh, I don't want to hear about it. We don't talk like that in heaven. There is no pain, there is no suffering in heaven, so forget about it. It's as if it never happened. Only happy talk is allowed in heaven. But I need to talk about it." "Shh," the angel said. "Keep it to yourself." How do you think that mother would feel in heaven? Desperately alone. Because forgetting is not healing. Forgetting is suppression. Ask any counselor, and the counselor will tell you that suppressing your painful memories only causes them to fester and grow worse. What we will need when we get to heaven is not to forget our earthly pain, but to be healed from our earthly pain. So when we get to heaven, if we've not already done so on earth, what we'll need to do is to face our pain, work through it, be healed from it. You see, when Revelation 21:4 says, "God will wipe away all tears," I understand that to mean you can't wipe away something that's not there. I understand that to mean that for many of us, when we enter heaven, there will still be tears that need to be wiped away. Healing that needs to happen if it hasn't happened on earth. So that when we get to heaven, what we're going to need is not to forget, but to face, to work through it. to learn from that suffering, to let it deepen us until we finally reach a point where eventually the beauty that flows out of what we've learned and internalized and how it has shaped our soul will begin to exceed the pain until we finally reach a point where, like Jesus, our scars become our glory. Because let me tell you something, when Jesus was standing there in heaven as a lamb that had been slaughtered, he was not in pain. He was not weeping. He was not reliving his pain. He was standing there triumphant. He was standing there as a symbol that he had overcome his suffering. What others, his oppressors, meant for harm to him, his crucifixion, God turned to his good and to the good of the world. The single greatest and most beautiful redemptive act in human history, so that instead of senseless suffering, the cross becomes Jesus vicariously taking upon himself the just penalty for the sins of the whole world. Talk about a plot twist. Isaiah chapter 53, verse 5, he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole, and by his stripes we are healed. What is the worst thing that you've ever done? Down here on planet Earth, things get pretty messy. Just ask this little girl, she could attest to that. A mother said to her daughter, "Why do you always get so dirty?" She said, "Mommy, I'm a lot closer to the ground than you are." Down here at ground level on Earth, we get pretty messy. We get pretty mucked up. What is the worst thing that you've ever done? The thing that brings you the most shame? On the cross, Jesus took the just punishment for that shameful thing upon himself so that you could be free from that, so that I could be free from that, which is why when the 24 elders saw Jesus in the form of the lamb that was slaughtered, instead of weeping, instead of feeling pain in their hearts, they broke out into songs of praise. Revelation 5:9, they sang out, "By your blood you ransom God for God, saints from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests serving our God." Then in verse 11, John says, "I looked and I heard the voice of many angels surrounding the throne and the living creatures and the elders. They numbered myriads of myriads, singing with full voice, because God and Jesus, working together, had taken Jesus' greatest earthly suffering and turned it into his crown of glory. The most beautiful redemptive act in the history of human life." Why would we ever want to forget that? True story. Years ago, back in the 1960s, Hawaii was hit by a tsunami. 60-foot waves crashed ashore, knocking down houses and buildings, creating rubble and sucking many people back out to sea. A man whose nickname was Bully, not because he was an actual bully, but because he was a big hulk of a guy, a gentle giant. Bully was working on a construction site at that point. He immediately raced home, finding his house in a heap of rubble and his wife standing there screaming, "I can't find Robbie," their six-month-old son. Bully says, "I was frantic. As I looked over the shore strewn with the remains of frail stick houses that were now piled in heaps along the sands,
Realizing that another wave may be soon following, I began running on top of the wooden structures, tearing up pieces of twisted, corrugated roofs. I tore up one piece after another, running over boards and broken beams until I heard the whimpering of a child under one of the mattresses that had gotten lodged beneath an overturned car. I reached under and pulled out my little boy, Robbie. I tucked him under my arm like a football player running for the end zone, sprinting over the debris until I reached my wife. Together, we ran for higher ground, hugging our child and one another, thanking God. Just then, my wife said, "Bully, your feet and your hands, you're covered in blood." Bully says, "I'd been wearing tennis shoes. I didn't realize that as I ran over the wreckage, I was stepping on protruding nails and screws that had been exposed from the rubble. And as I pulled back the torn, corrugated roofing, looking for Robbie, the sharp edges of the roofing tore into my hands. I was so intent on finding my boy, nothing else mattered." To this very day, decades later, Bully still bears on his hands and his feet the scars from that fateful day, to the point, he says, that oftentimes people who meet him will ask, "How did you get those scars?" When Bully looks down at his scars, what do you think he feels? Do you think he feels sorrow? Pain? No. Because those scars remind him of the greatest day of his life. And the single greatest accomplishment of his life, the day with reckless abandon, he saved his son. When he looks at those scars, he can't help but smile. It's like that with Jesus. Show me the scars, those beautiful scars, because throughout the ages, we will never forget that day on which Jesus' body was broken, that day on which Jesus and God, working together, took Jesus' greatest earthly suffering and transformed it into something incredibly redemptive. Why would we ever want to forget that? A man stood outside a British pub on a terribly rainy day. The old man was standing there in front of a large puddle, holding a stick with a string on it as if he was fishing in the puddle. A stranger comes walking by, stops, and says to the old man, "What are you doing?" "I'm fishing," the old codger says. Taking pity on him, the stranger says, "Come into the pub with me, I'll buy you a drink." In the warm ambiance of the pub, as they were drinking their whiskey and making conversation, the stranger who had invited him in, being something of a pompous snob, couldn't help but ask the old man, "So, how many have you caught today?" The old codger grinned and said, "You're the eighth." You didn't see that coming, did you? Another plot twist. Life is full of plot twists. And here is one last plot twist for you. What was true for Jesus, his greatest suffering, becoming his crown of glory? God also wants to be true for you and me. For each one of us. The Bible exhorts us, like Jesus, to embrace our suffering. Jesus says, Matthew 16:24, "Take up your cross and follow me." Because you see, the truth is, just as it was with Jesus, so with us. Your greatest earthly suffering has the potential
to shape your soul, to get redeemed and turned into something incredibly beautiful, so that throughout the ages, when you look down at your scars from your earthly existence, instead of weeping like Jesus, like Bully, you'll smile. Let me close with an example from Craig Greenfield's book, Subversive Jesus. As a young adult, there was a several years period where Craig Greenfield ministered in Cambodia, working for a Christian organization there that helped Cambodian orphans. There were many AIDS orphans in Cambodia at that time. One day, Craig met a 10-year-old boy named Tom. Both of his parents had died of AIDS, leaving him and his siblings an orphan. Since he was the oldest of the siblings, he's the one who nursed his mother and his father until they died. And he was the one responsible then for carrying forward and protecting his younger siblings. Can you imagine the pain that Tom experienced? Craig says Tom had always been poor. Even before his parents died, he would spend hours scavenging for Coke cans and for Tiger beer bottles to recycle for pennies to help supplement the family income. Then, shortly after his parents' death, there was a slum fire where they lived, and their shack was burned to the ground, destroying all mementos and photographs that he had left to remember his parents by. All Tom was left with now was his memories of times when he, his parents, his siblings would sit in a circle on the floor and eat their meals and laugh and talk. And on those rare occasions when there was a little extra rice left, his parents would pooch out their cheeks and purse their lips in that unique Cambodian fashion and say, "Eat more, eat more." Tom found a shack and relocated his siblings in another slum. And that's where Craig met Tom. Craig worked for an organization called Alongsiders, a Cambodian word that roughly means a godparent crossed with a big brother or big sister. The Alongsiders trained young Cambodian adults to be big brothers and big sisters to children who had been orphaned in Cambodia. So when Craig asked Tom, "Would you like your own Alongsider?" Tom lit up and said, "Yes." And from that point forward, Craig says, Tom blossomed. When he wasn't in school or scavenging for cans, he was often found in his shack studying the scriptures, growing in the Lord. When Craig asked him, "What are your dreams, Tom?" he said, to teach computer. Craig thought that was a pretty lofty dream for a kid who lived in the slums. But after Craig found an old used computer for Tom, Tom proved him wrong. Before long, Tom was holding classes for the kids in the slums, teaching them how to use this computer as they would crowd around him. Eventually, Craig moved away from Cambodia. But several years later, he came back to visit, anxious to look up Tom. He found him in the same shack, in the same alley, in the same slum. As he walked into the shack there, he found Tom sitting cross-legged on the ground with a little boy who looked to be about 10 years old sitting next to him with his tin cans on the floor. Tom was sharing lunch with him. Tom introduced the boy to Craig. The boy sort of tentatively looked up at him, and Craig says, "I could see in his eyes how good it felt to be wanted, to have somebody instead of being abandoned and alone." Craig says, "I watched as Tom pooched out his cheek and pursed his lips and said to the boy to take more of the leftover grizzly meat." Craig said to Tom, "Tom, you make a great Alongsider." Tom grinned, knowing firsthand the difference it makes to have a big brother in your life. Do you see what Tom is doing there? He is taking the greatest source of suffering in his life. All of the insights from that, all of the learning from that, all of the empathy that that gave him. And he's now applying that in a way that few can, to bless other orphans. His greatest suffering is now in the process of being transformed into his greatest life accomplishment, a crown of glory that will never fade away. Because you see, heaven is not going to be a place of forgetfulness. It will be a place where our worst memories get redeemed and transformed into something incredibly beautiful as part of God's redemptive plan. So let's go back to where we started, to that question: what is the source of greatest suffering you have ever experienced? Don't run from it. Don't suppress it. Embrace it. Learn from it. Let it deepen you. Because if you do, your greatest source of suffering could become your crowning glory in this life and throughout eternity. Now that would be a plot twist. Like Jesus, turn the tables on your suffering. Amen.